Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 5:06. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Though it's called the most important meal of the day by a lot of people, breakfast doesn't always get the respect it may deserve.
Well, how many of us actually take the time to cook a decent breakfast each morning instead of grabbing that breakfast bar and rushing out the door? Well, our next guest says this isn't the first time in human history that people have overlooked the importance and cultural significance of breakfast.
Heather Arndt Anderson joins us. Her new book is Breakfast, A History. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, we take breakfast for granted as one of the meals of the day. Not everybody has through history. Are there times when people just haven't eaten breakfast at all?
Well, yes. There have been times when not only did people not eat breakfast, but they were instructed to not do so because of religious beliefs or because of advice from physicians.
Wait, religious was, it was sinful to eat breakfast for at some points in time?
Yes. Thomas Aquinas laid out several different forms of gluttony that one could commit, and one of them pertained to eating too quickly after one's previous meal. And so breakfast was sort of considered to be a meal eaten too soon after dinner. And so it was considered a form of gluttony to eat breakfast for a few hundred years in Europe.
Wow. And they didn't even know about the Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's.
They sure would have been.
That would not have gone over well. Well, when did the idea of, you know, a modern breakfast, this bacon and eggs thing that we have going, you know, in America, although maybe it's being usurped by Greek yogurt now, but where did that come from?
Well, bacon and eggs has been around for hundreds of years. Smoked meats and eggs have been eaten since the Paleolithic era. But bacon and eggs together have been eaten since, the 17th century. The first people to recommend it were physicians, and poached eggs were recommended to eat with bacon for a proper and wholesome breakfast.
Well, it's interesting how the pendulum swings, because then you write about the invention of cereal. Can you talk about the health movement and the attitude toward breakfast that led to the first cornflake?
Yeah, and actually that is tangentially related to religion as well. Some of the early proponents of clean living movement and the Grahamites, so Sylvester Graham was, I believe he was a Quaker, those guys were all really interested in whole grains and unprocessed foods. As a matter of keeping one's soul as wholesome as one's body.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, so Graham invented the first kind of cereals with his, you know, Graham flour, and Dr. James Caleb Jackson was right after him with his invention of granola. But the cornflakes were invented by sort of the next generation of that movement, the early Seventh-day Adventists, who were opening sanitaria all over the Midwest, especially in Michigan. They're opening up these health spas where wealthy people could go and sort of clean out their bowels and get a little hydropathy, a little spa treatment, and they would be served various whole grain foods and always vegetarian. And then flaked cereal was invented at the one that was owned by the Kellogg brothers. They were cooking up some grains and trying to figure out some new ways to serve these foods, and they got called away from the kitchen, and when they came back, they realized that their pot of simmering wheat was completely overcooked. It was this really gnarly, dried-out mush on the stove, and they had, you know, to keep an eye on their bottom line, and so they decided to try to salvage it, and they rolled it between these steel rollers into these thin sheets to try to dry it out, and when it broke up into flakes, they realized that it tasted pretty good, and their clientele liked it, and so they started experimenting with other grains as well, and that's when they came across cornflakes.
And yet, you know, hasn't porridge been around for a long time? We hear mentions of gruel, I think, in the Middle Ages. You know, it's anything sort of gloppy and mushy in a bowl. That goes back to the Middle Ages, doesn't it?
it goes back to the Paleolithic era as well. And I always will apologize to my friends who adhere to the trendy paleo diet, but porridge and bread, as you know, as well as smoked meats and eggs and also tea, have been eaten since the late Paleolithic era. Humans have been grinding and processing grains for just millennia. And so, yeah, eating porridge goes back to thousands and thousands of years before the Middle Ages.
Well, what's a breakfast eater to do? We've had recommendations everywhere from, you know, the bacon and eggs and mutton and heavy meat breakfast to humble grain and fruit to no breakfast at all. Is there actually any science that says what we should eat for breakfast that you came across?
Well, there's lots of science, and that's the problem. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So I think that people should just eat when they're hungry and eat what their body is craving. I mean, obviously, people will crave really salty and sweet and fatty foods that aren't that great for them. But eating something is typically better than eating nothing, which is what the science says now. And the guidance has been that way for a few hundred years. It was really only during the Middle Ages when eating breakfast was frowned upon, but it was generally agreed that people who had to do work, like labor or children or the elderly, still needed to eat some food. And so there were plenty of people that were still eating breakfast, even though the guidance said to stop doing it.
Can you tell us a little about the evolution of, you know, the pancake? Because things like that, waffles and crepes, it's really just a sneaky way to get us, you know, let us eat cake for breakfast, isn't it? And yet it's, you know, it's accepted as a decent breakfast. You can throw some buckwheat in there, some blueberries, and it's passable. Where did that come from?
Well, pancakes didn't start out as a breakfast food. I think that they probably, in fact, in a lot of places in the world, they still are considered to be desserts, and same with waffles. Adding fruit, like berries, to pancakes is a purely American invention and didn't come until Maine in the 19th century, which it's really interesting to me that it came so late because those are such obvious choices to have together. I don't know why it took so long. But yeah, I mean, even the ancient Greeks were eating some honey on their pancakes. They would just fry these thin batters in olive oil and then serve it with honey, and that was just a nice treat. But they weren't really eating it for breakfast.
You know, here, maybe it's just an American thing. In the United States, we have this concept of this is a breakfast food, and eating it later in the day for dinner is a bit naughty. You know, pancakes for supper, what? Do other cultures have such firm distinctions between breakfast and not breakfast foods?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, I might be mistaken. I have only lived in America, but I think that Americans fret about this stuff much more than other people. I know in Europe, they will eat some foods like, you know, in Italy, they'll just have a little bit of bread and jam with coffee, and they wouldn't have that for dinner, and certainly they wouldn't have, you know, like pasta or risotto for breakfast. In Asia, you see a lot more foods that we consider to be savory or dinner foods eaten for breakfast, a lot of noodle soups, miso soup in Japan with grilled fish. I think it's just a uniquely American thing. I have not been able to suss out the reasons why. I think that these kinds of cultural differences are always up for philosophy and debate.
And just in that same vein, when I was traveling in New Zealand, we all we went to a cafe and we all ordered our eggs a different way, scrambled and over easy and yolk hard. And the guy just looked at us and said, "You're American, aren't you?" He said, "Nobody but American asks for their eggs in all these different ways. Here, there's just you order eggs, you get eggs." So that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, Americans really do like choice. I hear in other parts of the world, they only sell one type of dental floss.
How do they survive?
You know,
that sounds pretty nice.
Yeah,
actually,
no,
you don't
really
have
does.
To wade through all the yeah. So, is there something about, you know, our Americans? Are we used to too many breakfast choices?
I think that if we are, it's pretty recent. Well, it's not that recent. Our country is very recent, but you know, since the Industrial Revolution, when we had the birth of the middle class, I think we started getting more of this money that people had to use in more frivolous ways, and so disposable income means there's always going to be people finding a way to get that money from people. And so coming up with new ways to spend money on either a new breakfast room for your house or, you know, new dishes that are just for breakfast, the cereal bowl and the cereal spoon that are only to be used at those meals. I think that there was all this new money and people wanted to find a way to show it off and flash it around a little bit.
We're talking ahead. Oh. We're talking to Heather Arndt Anderson about the history of breakfast, and we want to hear from you. Do you make breakfast a priority in your life? And what is your breakfast? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with Heather right after this. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Heather Arndt Anderson about the history of breakfast.
And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the supposedly most important meal of the day? And what do you eat for breakfast? Is there something you eat each and every day? Is it something we usually wouldn't think of as a breakfast food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or head over to the Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
And Heather, we want to ask you about something a lot of people say they can't live without. It's usually associated with breakfast, but not always. But usually that's the way the day starts. Coffee. Tell us something about how coffee got so prominent first thing in the morning.
Wow, coffee, I agree, is very important in the morning, especially in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah.
Well, coffee was invented... It wasn't really invented. It was discovered by an Ethiopian goat herder, according to popular stories. And he has seen his goats eating these little red berries and then prancing around the countryside. He gave them a try and found that he was filled with poetry and energy. And so he shared it with the people. And, you know, for a long time, this carried on. And then trade brought coffee to the Middle East, and this was a really wonderful thing. By the 17th century, it did end up coming to Europe, and it came right at the same time as tea and chocolate. And so all at once, Europe got three different ways to become caffeinated. And I think the ban on breakfast went away very quickly after that. People started really enjoying this, and it was just a coincidence because the caffeinated beverages were enjoyed as an afternoon treat. But again, in the rise of the working class and the middle class, people really did need that little jump in the morning because there was more of a standardized work day and standardized meal times. And after it became more affordable to get tea and coffee, people did start really enjoying the benefits of it in the morning.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Brian on the line in Trempealeau. Brian, hi.
Hi.
What's your breakfast story?
My breakfast story, I work 12-hour days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We start at 3 a.m. So we have our first breakfast at 6 o'clock, which normally I'll have coffee and a cinnamon roll or something like that. But then for second breakfast at 9 o'clock, typically I would eat like a lunch, a hamburger or maybe some lasagna or other kind of pasta, spaghetti. And then at lunchtime, then we would have another lunch. But that's my funny story for breakfast.
And you actually call it second breakfast?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a hobbit's dream come true. I think that's the only other place I've run across that. Have you run across multiple breakfast options?
Me?
Heather, yes. Sorry. Have you run across multiple breakfast options?
Yeah. In fact, in Europe, the Italians will actually often just have a little bit, or the French will have a little cafe au lait in the morning, and that's it. And then a few hours later, they'll go have a little bit of breakfast. And I think that American fast food restaurants find that that is a pretty common trend, too. People get a little something on the way to work, and then they want to have their 10 o'clock coffee break, where they also have something else to eat at the same time.
All right. Well, thanks to Brian for that. And we'll go next to Bruce in Burlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Hey, what do you think about breakfast?
For 47 years, I neglected myself and just ate whatever I wanted. But in an effort to take care of myself, breakfast has become a big part of that. And so I start my day with three eggs, which I typically poach in the microwave, and a bowl of oatmeal.
Three eggs and oatmeal. So you're really covering all your breakfast bases there. Do you feel better having eaten all that?
Oh, my goodness. The first day I started eating better intentionally, I felt so much better, and I didn't realize I had felt lousy prior to that. So it's made a difference.
So interesting.
I've also managed to lose 4 pant sizes since November, so I'm doing something right.
Interesting.
I think you've got a book deal in the works. The egg and oatmeal weight loss plan.
Well, it sounds like it's been working for you, Bruce. Is that common, Heather, that people who do eat breakfast and they pay attention to it, do they feel better? Because we do hear, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Is it true?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that people who eat breakfast weigh less than people who skip breakfast. And I think that when the body is in starvation mode all night, when you're sleeping, you're essentially fasting, and so breaking the fast in the morning is a way to kickstart your metabolism. And that's just according to what a lot of common dietitian advice is happening today. I certainly feel better when I eat some breakfast, so I can speak anecdotally there.
Mm.
Well, you've mentioned some things that go back to the Paleolithic era in the breakfast world. Here's one that probably didn't. Our producer, Chris Molina, said he started his day with Lucky Charms cereal bars. And that brings up the idea we've got all these convenient breakfast foods. Where do those come from? And are they really taking over our breakfast these days?
Well, they definitely are more available than they ever have been. And I think that a lot of people like to implicate the post-war rise of the working mother for the rise in convenience foods. But convenience foods really started coming out after World War I. And I think it's because personal cooks or family cooks in households, they just weren't available anymore. And anyone who watches Downton Abbey knows that after the war, they, you know, were scrambling for household staff. So I think that mothers and housewives who had never had to cook before really came to rely on these products. And then, of course, after World War II, when more mothers and women were entering the workforce, they really did need the convenience foods because they didn't have the time to be spending all day cooking.
Now, we've talked about convenience foods, and what about another cultural staple that has to do with breakfast, the rise of brunch? It seems like it's reached sort of epic proportions of brunching, at least in cities among certain social circles. What happened with brunch being sort of the high art form of breakfast?
Brunch is an interesting thing, and it's a pretty recent construct. There's actually another book in the series that is dedicated to brunch, but the first use of the word brunch didn't occur in print until the late 19th century, so it's 1895. And in that context, it was considered to be a nice way to spend one's Sunday morning. Instead of getting up early for church, you could just lounge around eating brunch and, you know, have this really, it would be a nice way to start one's week, wouldn't it? And I think that it was kind of a throwback to the old golden age of breakfast when you had, you know, 6 or 7 course breakfasts on a daily basis. You know, after the Industrial Revolution, like I mentioned before, people had more of a standardized workday and just didn't have the time to spend eating, you know, kidney stew with waffles and oats and 5 different kinds of eggs and bacon. And so it was kind of a way to harken back to those, you know, the glory days of breakfast. And then you also didn't have to get up so early. So it was kind of the best of both worlds, I think.
Time for one more call. We have Lisa on the line in Milwaukee. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind for breakfast?
Well, for both myself and my son. Now, he's 20 years old, but he's always been a fussy eater. Would not touch breakfast foods at all. But I was of the mind that I don't care what you eat as long as you eat. So most of the time, I'd be making hot dogs at 7 in the morning. And that's what he would eat, and that's what he would eat for breakfast.
Well, I think a lot of the world agrees with you on that one. They're not always eating the sausages. They're eating whatever is handy. What do you think about that, Heather?
Well, technically, a hot dog is a type of sausage, so you're a good mother. yeah, I think that throughout the world, people eat foods that Americans would never consider to be breakfast foods. And, you know, I've had Thai noodle soup for breakfast, and it's just a really wonderful thing. I don't think that it always has to be about wheat and eggs and sage-infused meats. I think that getting something is better than getting nothing.
Well, Heather, we've had a loose end dangling through the entire interview so far. What do you eat for breakfast?
What do I eat? Well, I am a fan of scrambled egg and a tortilla with some cheese and salsa. Good old breakfast burrito.
Right. Like on the weekends, or is that like your everyday breakfast?
That's my everyday. On weekends, I go crazy. In fact, you guys in the Midwest might appreciate that I make my own version of a hot dish. I make a tater tot breakfast casserole for breakfast on the weekends.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's just tater tots with you pour in some beaten egg and maybe some cheese and peppers, something else if you like meat, and then bake it, and it's like a frittata. It's classy.
Excellent. It sounds like something that you'd find right at home here in Wisconsin. Well, Heather sounds tasty, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Heather Arn Anderson, a food writer based in Portland, Oregon. Her book is called Breakfast, A History.
So, Veronica, we made her tell us what's your breakfast.
Mine is so boring today.
Me
had
too.
Peanut butter toast.
Oh, okay. I do that sometimes. I am a cereal guy. I eat for years, like my whole life. Sometimes I'm like, I want to eat something other than cereal. I always come back to the cereal.
I can never let it go.
Really?
And it's Michael Feldman's fault.
There's a story there.
There is. I heard there were bug parts allowable in cereal, which I'm sure is true of most food, but that is why I don't eat cereal.
Wow. Added protein and calcium.
I know.
Well, coming up next, we'll look at some of the news of the day, including the terrorist attacks in Kenya. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We turn our attention to Nairobi, Kenya, where gunmen opened fire on an upscale shopping mall.
At least 60 people are reported dead, and there's been an ongoing hostage situation involving an estimated 10 to 15 militant attackers.
The group reportedly behind the terror plot is Al-Shabaab, an extremist Islamic group based in Somalia.
But who are Al-Shabaab, and what's led to this weekend's attack? Well, here to explain is Jeremy Suri. He's Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on, Veronica.
Well, Al-Shabaab is a group that we haven't heard that much about, at least in the U.S. media. What do we need to know about it?
Well, there's a lot that can be said, but there are three things I think we would want to make sure we keep in mind. First of all, they're a group that grew out of the dissolution of a longstanding military dictatorship in Somalia in the 1990s and the civil war that followed. Second, they are closely associated with a number of Islamic extremists, though that does not mean that everyone in the group is an Islamic extremist, whatever that means. And then third, they've been engaged in an effort to gain control of Somalia, a battle they have been losing the prior few years. And it looks as if they've turned to these international terrorist activities because they're not winning on the battlefield, in fact.
Well, tell us a little bit about what we know about why this Somalia-based group targeted a site in Nairobi, Kenya.
Well, the Kenyan military, along with African Union forces, has been involved in trying to bring peace and stability to Somalia, trying to support the national government, which is the enemy of the Al-Shabaab group and its supporters. And the Kenyan military has been playing the role both of enforcer and, to some extent, peacekeeper. So this was a successful story for Kenya and the African Union, but it's not seen that way by members of Al-Shabaab, and they're, in a sense, taking out revenge on the Kenyan military.
Now, do we know how much this group is trying to become a global terrorist threat and how much they're simply interested in regaining a foothold in Somalia?
Well, that's the big debate that all the experts in my field are having as we speak. And I, quite frankly, myself don't know for certain. I don't have any inside knowledge on that. It appears that the group Al-Shabaab is recruiting people from outside of Somalia. There's even talk of there being some even Western members of the group that attacked the mall in Nairobi. And it appears that they are looking to use international terror as a weapon. But whether they're seeking to do that on a global scale, I'm not sure. They look to me like a regional terrorist organization now, operating throughout Northern Africa and maybe even in the Middle East. It's hard for me to see evidence of them acting beyond those regional areas right now.
Now, besides this mall in Nairobi, Kenya, are there other ongoing threats or previous attacks that have been put down to Al-Shabaab?
Well, they are they're the ones who people believe, experts believe, are responsible for a number of attacks in Uganda in 2010. And there are a number of other allegations that they've been involved in other smaller-scale attacks. What we do know for certain is that they were on a watch list by American, Kenyan, Israeli, and other intelligence agencies. And, in fact, this mall in Kenya was a target that many had worried about, and there had been efforts to get the Kenyan government to secure them all better. So this did not come out of the blue. It might be unheard of to American newspaper readers, but intelligence agencies have been focused on this group for quite a while.
Now, you mentioned earlier that they had some affiliations with other terrorist organizations. Is Al-Qaeda one of them, and how deep do those ties go?
Well, that's also a very complicated question. There are members of what had been Al-Qaeda or still is Al-Qaeda who have some connections to Al-Shabaab. But what I think it's really important that listeners understand is that Al-Qaeda is no longer a very centralized organization. It's not based around one figure like Osama bin Laden. There are many offshoots, many groups that claim to be part of Al-Qaeda that are not. It's a very loose organization. And there are people from that loose organization that have been associated with Al-Shabaab. But I don't think this is some plot that's been cooked up by some figure in Afghanistan, as we had with September 11th. This is a much more loosely organized network.
Now, I suppose if we're looking at ties between al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda, one thing that people in the United States might wonder is, does that mean that the U.S. and its interests abroad are now a target of this group as well, especially if it's trying to have a more international profile?
Well, I think we already were a target, and they were not necessarily directly involved with the attack on the American embassy in 1998, but the American embassy in Nairobi was attacked for similar reasons because of our presence in the region. We are seen as a supporter in the region of governments that are not favorable to Islamist groups, and so we are a target, and I think we can expect that we'll be even more of a target in that region. I'm not sure this should lead us to worry more about other parts of the world, but perhaps it raises a premium on people attacking American installations. That's a possibility.
So do you know of any ongoing U.S. efforts to combat al-Shabaab, similar to what we may have done in an offensive against al-Qaeda?
Yes. I mean, we've been involved already in helping the Kenyan military and helping the African Union both take away their supply lines, limit their access to capital, financial capital, intercept their communications. We've been sharing intelligence with the Kenyan military. We actually have a very close working relationship, our military intelligence does, with the Kenyan military intelligence units. So we've already been working against this group. And as I said, there had already been plans to try to secure areas in Nairobi that were seen as possible targets. And this is one of the reasons why I think it is fair to assume that al-Shabaab will attack American installations or try to because of our close relationship with the Kenyan military.
So what do you think the Obama administration is thinking now that this is a big, high-profile terrorist attack with U.S. ties? They are there. They might not be as apparent, you know, when you're sitting here in America. But,
right.
How does it look to the Obama administration?
Well, I think, first of all, it raises concerns that there will be attacks on Americans in the region. And as bad as this is, it's, of course, much more of a concern to the President of the United States when Americans are directly targeted. And I think there is also concern that we'll see copycat, even if not directly related, activities elsewhere. This will, in the short run, however, reaffirm our connection to Kenya, the Kenyan government, and it will reaffirm our efforts to support those governments in the region that are fighting against al-Shabaab. So it will actually reinforce American policy and make it more public than it has been before.
Now, in the earlier days when we were fighting al-Qaeda, analysts compared it to a many-headed hydra. You cut off one head, another pops up. Is this just another head, or is al-Qaeda and terrorist organization in general weakening globally, do you think? And this is maybe an outlier?
Well, I think this is a very hard question to operate and really put into practice when you're doing research. My sense from reading some of the material about these groups is that they are less capable today, Veronica, than they were 10 years ago to launch a big attack on a hardened target in the United States or somewhere else. So I don't think a September 11th attack is as likely or they're as capable of it as they were before. On the other hand, I think there are more of these small groups. I wouldn't call it a many-headed hydra. I call them franchises, small outgrowths, small separate businesses that are loosely associated with a central terrorist ambition. And they are operating on a smaller scale, and they can actually operate more easily. Think of all the soft targets, malls and things of that sort around the world. And they are capable of getting weapons and training themselves and recruiting people to take on these attacks. So they are more capable, the terrorists are, of small attacks. I think they're less capable of big attacks.
Now, do you expect any response from the U.S. or maybe a U.N. response to this?
I think there will be more aid, military aid in particular, to Kenyan and African Union forces that are fighting in the southern Somali countryside al-Shabaab groups. You will see more efforts to find where their money is and intercept that, more efforts to intercept their communications. And if we are able to find some of the leaders of the group, people we think are leaders, and we can kill them with drones, I don't think it's unthinkable that Obama would use drones in this region where he has not used them as far as we know yet. But I don't know if we have the ability to target and figure out who the leaders of this group are.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jeremy Suria, professor at the University of Texas, Austin.
This is Central Time. A new project is looking for your help in keeping tabs on Wisconsin wildlife. The Wildlife Data Integration Network is out to create more citizen scientists to help them get a more complete picture of wildlife health. We have Megan Hines and Chris Marsh in the studio with us. They're both with the Wildlife Data Integration Network. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Chris, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, first of all, what are you trying to tap into here? Some of us are already sort of doing this, but maybe don't even know it. Megan, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So we have a couple of different projects that we're working on as a part of this Global Health Institute project, essentially looking for novel sources of information for discovering wildlife health events in the news, as well as from citizen scientists, and looking through passive observations that are shared with us through Twitter.
And then, Chris, how do you mine this? What kind of things are you watching for on Twitter?
That actually is a better question for Megan.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Megan.
She's
been working closer with the folks.
Sure. So working with some computer scientists faculty on the UW campus here at UW-Madison, Jerry Zhu and his graduate student, Jun Ming, we've been looking at training his machine learning system, which essentially takes keywords and looks for observations of wildlife health reports from the general public. And we're looking for firsthand reports. So I saw a dead bird, or I saw a dead squirrel, things like that. And so, and using this machine learning system, we're essentially trying to train it using natural language processing techniques and other techniques to better identify these observations.
So I see a dead crow in my backyard. I type a note, and then this project, ideally, you know, I put it on Twitter or something, and then this project scouts it out and adds it to the data, the roster.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So with the different information channels, that's exactly what we're looking to do, is to glean this very basic epidemiological information from the wildlife health event, you know, where it was located, what kind of species were affiliated there, and some other basic information. And then we can turn those information, that basic kind of passive observation, into a standardized point of data. And that can help to build up what everyone is looking for in kind of the epidemiological health area of baseline understanding. You know, how common are these events? Is this something significant? And so it's in the power of uniting these different sources of novel information that will help to complement the traditional sources that you see coming out of state agencies, federal agencies, and so on.
So do we have a shortfall in the data we have now?
Yes. We are hoping to fill that gap of information with these novel sources, mm-hmm. looking at the news, filtering Twitter, and also significantly getting contributions from citizen scientists. One single report from a person is highly valuable, especially when it contributes to the larger group of observations.
So right now, the people who are tracking this stuff maybe know what's going on state lands, or the stuff the DNR wardens are seeing, but that sounds like a huge gap then to be filled in.
Right, totally. So that's essentially what we're doing, is reaching out to the general public to make them aware of the significance that these individual contributions can make to that baseline understanding, as well as to help identify perhaps something new emerging. So like an example, in the last year or so, there have been some salmonella outbreaks that had to do with birds at bird feeders and perhaps not being as clean as they should be. And so the DNR received a lot of these reports about kind of seeing birds at the bird feeders that had some interesting characteristics, and were able to respond with those citizen observations to say, hey, you know, pull your bird feeders, either keep them down or, you know, wash them with bleach. So it helps with some response strategies as well.
So right now, it sounds like the first step is just taking advantage of what people are already doing? Are you also going to be trying to get more people to go to Twitter, go to Facebook, and make these kind of reports?
Yeah, exactly. We've been doing a number of outreach efforts over the past year, and we're trying to reach both the general public to make them aware of these tools and that these professionals out there are interested in seeing those observations. And we're also doing outreach to people who might consume that data, who might want to take advantage of the alerts and the email alerts and the RSS alerts that come out of this system, essentially to keep them up to date and provide a possibility for collaboration and communication to respond to these events.
Well, a lot of people care about wildlife, would be interested in helping just for that reason. Is there something more in it for us, though, if we know more about the diseases affecting the non-human animals in our state?
Absolutely. Wildlife health can tell us or be an indication of zoonotic diseases that we as humans need to be concerned about, and also foreign animal diseases that our domestic animals could be a problem for.
So here's what's in it for us. If we tweet sick animals, seeing sick animals, dead animals around, we might help track down a disease that might someday jump to us.
Correct.
Am I hearing that right?
Correct.
Now let's talk about the concept of citizen science more generally. It's a word, it's a phrase that I've heard floating around a lot. Is there a value to, you know, the non-trained lay people like, you know, me getting involved and helping out with science?
Certainly. I mean, if you think about it on the landscape, you know, how many in this particular area, how many wildlife biologists are employed and looking for these observations? And like you said, that they may be biased towards monitoring state or federal lands. And so we've got a large gap in private land ownership and reports that we could take advantage of the general public from. But it's also, you know, I think it's transforming and kind of burgeoning right now, this field of citizen science, because of this access to technology, smartphones, and all these applications that enable people to, you know, easily contribute what they see. And there is some value, you know, that a lot of citizens find from contributing to this data set, especially if they are, you know, shown how this information can be used to supplement this traditional information.
A lot of times when I've heard in the news about citizen science, it's usually in the astronomy field. You know, somebody makes a discovery of a comet, an asteroid, a star, a galaxy, something like that. And I think it's just because there's so much universe out there, all the astronomers can't be watching it all at one time. Are you going for a similar thing with our Wisconsin wildlife?
Absolutely. We are trying to use the power of observations through citizens to expand the capacity to find these events and make a record of them.
Is there any kind of training we could use? I mean, I'm not going out there with a thermometer and sticking it in, you know, a deer's mouth to assess its well-being, right?
No, we do not encourage people to interact with wildlife, whether it's healthy or sick. But the basic observations of if you see an animal that appears to be sick, that you can make an observation of the date when it happened, the location, the species, just very basic information can be extremely helpful.
Let's talk about how it works on a practical level. I see that sick animal or the animal acting strangely. I get note the time and place. Do I just tweet it to my buddies, or are there ways that it can be drawn to your attention so that the smart computer doesn't have to dig quite so hard?
Yeah, currently with the one of our projects, the Wildlife Health Event Reporter, anyone, members of the general public or professionals, can sign up for a free account and then essentially start to make a report, just like Chris said, you know, essentially looking for the date, location, and some basic details. And if there are photos that can go along with it, that might also help a lot, especially on the other end when we invite scientists and researchers to look at this information. Having that additional observation information, such as pictures of the area where the event took place or pictures of the animals themselves, would be very helpful.
Now, who on the other end, we've kind of talked on what we, the citizen scientists, would be doing. You get that data, you surf Twitter, you take these accounts and collect that info. Who then gets to look at it and try to make sense of, uh-oh, we've got a crow disease outbreak in Sector 7?
So oftentimes a lot of these reports really aren't about disease. It's just an observation itself. But those can be very helpful. You know, Chris said on earlier, at the individual level together, they can start to show a picture of where you might raise red flags and see concern. You know, this is still a very experimental tool, but we do have people who monitor and sign up for alerts that come out of the Wildlife Health Event Reporter project. Essentially, anyone can sign up to receive email alerts or RSS feed alerts, which are essentially data. And so that XML RSS feed alert can be linked into outside systems, too. So we're not necessarily asking people to change what they're doing, but provide this additional channel of information.
Did you invent this from whole cloth, or is this something that's working elsewhere and people here in Wisconsin got excited and said, hey, that's an idea we should borrow or steal?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the citizen science kind of application itself is, like you said, it's kind of burgeoning, and a lot of people are starting, scientists are starting to engage the public with their research in order to kind of establish a broader net of observations. In the wildlife health realm, there are a few other applications going on the internet. There are some people who are interested in roadkill observations to help transform kind of transportation planning, or even to monitor habitats that are sensitive, where you might have salamanders doing over road crossings and things like that. But anyway, yeah, it's a pretty broad, broadly used kind of technique to gather additional information.
If we're just about out of time, but I want to know if someone's hearing this and says, I can do that, I can help out, what's their next step? How do they get in touch, or where do they go to find out how to contribute information?
Sure. They can Google or Google the Wildlife Health Event Reporter Project, or WHER, and sign up for an account or some of the alerts that are available there. They can get in touch with us, with the School of Veterinary Medicine, Megan Hines and Chris Marsh.
All right. Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chris, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Megan Hines and Chris Marsh. They are both with the Wildlife Data Integration Network.